Hello and welcome to episode 157 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my life's dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. On this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by songwriter, musician, Chris Free. He was one half of the duo A-Craze, who was signed to Paul Weller's Respond record label in the early 1980s. We chat about his love of punk, including The Jam and The Clash and his first band, The Users, to meeting Lucy Baron, forming A-Craze, and getting signed to The Weller Project. The band played on the Respond package tours on lineups featuring Tracy Young, The Questions, and Vaughan Toulouse. They released one single, the Paul Weller produced Wearing Your Jumper, and we'll dig into that, along with a Respond sampler LP, Love the Reason. We'll talk about the love of A-Craze in Japan, which saw Chris and Lucy getting the band back together in 2009 for a compilation album called Such Bliss. And we'll dig into Chris's own projects, The Sound of Pop Art and a Mad Affair EP, which were produced by Andy Lewis. Yes, another Paul Weller connection there. Let's get into it. Chris Free, thanks for joining me.
Great. Thanks, Dan, for asking.
First of all, let's clarify on the band name that we're going to be talking about, because at some points you were called The Craze on different posters with Mr. Weller and the Respond tour and stuff. Then it became A-Craze. Which one do you prefer?
I know, we were always A-Craze. I think things like the Aylesbury Friars poster, which I have seen, that was just a mistake.
All right.
They were obviously told the Craze by some kind of PR person who was probably thinking about other things or something. Yeah. Lucy came up with the name. I don't know where she dreamed that up from.
Okay, nice. Well, thank you for clearing that up, because I did wonder. Let's first kick off with the, obviously it's a Paul Weller fan podcast. We should kick off with Mr. Weller. Yeah. When was it you first discovered the music of The Jam? Because punk was a big thing for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I was sort of going at school. I went to a secondary one school and said the school discos were sort of Motown with sort of glam, sort of Slade and all the rest of it, and T-Rex. Then there was a guy at school, Kevin Stern, and he was getting anything associated with Bowie, and he came to school with Raw Power, Iggy and the Stooges, one day. And I think he came home to mine afterwards to play it on the little sort of, it wasn't a dance set, it was a sort of suitcase speaker, Sanio, I think it was called. And the two, it looked like a suitcase, and you opened it out to two speakers on top, and then it was a little record deck. And anyway, so I had Raw Power, and I thought, God, I really like this. And funny enough, I kind of, the actual track Raw Power reminded me of Dancing in the Street. It seemed to have a straight beat, but it had this chunky guitar. And then that was about whenever that was, 74, 75. And then we were hearing things like New York Dolls, MC5, always along with The Who and, Motown things. Then going to punk group, then punk started happening. I first came across The Jam, obviously, with, I didn't go to London. I was in Cambridge when In the City came out. And that was like just a fantastic pop single to me. I loved all the, the guitar street overdubs and stuff. And it was just a great, great single. And you could tell that this lot must be very talented. And I did actually at that time, The Jam played the Corn Exchange in Cambridge. And I don't think I went to the gig, but I do remember a hamburger stand on the Market Square late on. Either we were playing somewhere as The Users or something, but I was in the Market Square about midnight, and then there was Weller there at the same kiosk or whatever, and I kind of thought, oh, that's Paul Weller. Didn't say anything, but, we were just standing there and getting hamburgers at the time.
For a second there, I thought you were going to say, I can't quite remember if I was at the Jam gig or not, but what I do remember is this amazing burger I had.
Yeah. Well, it always struck me, I did sort of think, oh, that's Paul Weller.
It was just really tasty. I can't remember if I saw one of the greatest bands in Britain ever, but yeah. I do remember that brilliant hamburger.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, I tell you what, I did see the Jam. The famous Clash gig at the Rainbow with the Jam, the Clash, I forget, it could have been Susie and the Banshees or the Buzzcocks. There was about five where all the seats got ripped out. And I remember seeing them, I don't know if that was before In the City came out or not, probably before it came out. And I do remember thinking, oh, they remind me a bit of Dr. Feelgood, who I loved at the time. Loved Wilco and all the rest of it. And I thought, wow, they're fantastic. Then I thought, well, bloody hell, what is this Clash lot going to be like? Anyway, the Clash came on, were absolutely out of this world at that gig. And then from that gig, I went and saw two or three Clash on that White Riot tour at Chelmsford and Dunstable. And I subsequently saw them later, and I never thought they were as good as the early Clash just before there, were just out of this world. And they were different because I'd seen Feelgoods and I kind of could relate to where the jam come from. They were fantastic, but the Clash just had the edge for me then. That leads on to going. I really took notice of All Mod Cons. That's the one that got me.
And we'll talk about, you know, where this comes from you, this you know, the music and wanting to be in it and wanting to sign a band and all that. But as somebody who loves writing, presumably Mr. Weller and his lyrics has been an inspiration in that sense.
Yeah. You know, he's written so many great songs, and there were so many great lyrics in that early jam period. It's quite incredible. You know, obviously some people get blessed with some incredible talent. A Town Called Malice, that lyric always, I think, is fantastic. And, well, there's loads of them, isn't there? I mean, and it just goes on and on. I guess it gets more difficult for him now, although he's really kept it together. I think having sort of younger band members and what he's surrounded with, you know, you see everyone else is sort of a bit detached from reality, but he's managed to sort of maintain that thing for ages, you know.
Let me ask about you. So here we are in Cambridge. You're growing up in Cambridge, and these bands obviously are an influence because you start a band as well. Or what age did you get into playing music? And tell me about The Users, which was a punk band that you formed.
Somewhere around when I was about 14, 15, at that point, music was really, really important, or pop music. It was like, and it was funny because there was only like Top of the Pops or an Old Grey Whistle Test, and probably pretty much nothing else, and sort of Radio 1 countdown to the charts each week. And then there were these music press papers like NME, Melody Maker, and NME was in school every week, sort of read like a Bible. But so much so around that time that the teacher, our sports teacher, Sam Summers, he sold me Exile on Main Street and Beggar's Banquet. Teachers would come in.
Were they allowed to sell stuff to the kids?
Well, that was it. I mean, teachers would come in with albums. Everyone was doing sort of swaps and stuff.
Brilliant.
And that's how it was, you know. And it was a totally different world. This when I was about 14. I was listening to Beggar's Banquet, and there was a track called Parachute Wound, which is a track called Beggar's Banquet. And I thought, God, I'd like to play that on the guitar. And it was just a down, out, and down, down, out, and down. I still remember it now. And I thought, God, I'd really like to be able to play that. And then, so somewhere around there, I got an acoustic guitar, and I got in Miller's in Cambridge, I got a sort of guitar music book for that album, and that's where it started, basically, and then started playing guitar. I just wanted to write songs right from the word go. That's what I saw the purpose of having this guitar instrument, was to write songs, you know. Obviously, the Beatles had grown up with the Beatles on the radio and all the rest of it, and the whole thing seemed to be like this was a vehicle to express yourself. Pop music was that. And so pretty soon, I think after about, you know, a year of playing or something, year and a half, retaking GCSEs, and there was a guy, Andrew, and played drums, and we said, oh, let's get three or four of us together. And very quickly, we suddenly had a group, Users, and we were just started writing straight away. And I think we played one gig, Raw Records, Lee Wood, I think saw us. Oh, we used to go into his record shop. There used to be record shops everywhere, and he would play us things like The Creation and all this kind of stuff. And we got to this idea of setting up our own record label, which was going to be, funny enough, Raw Power Records. But what happened? He paid for us to go and demo some tracks, four tracks, and in Spaceford Studios. And then what happened was about, I don't know when it was, about a month or so later, we walk into Andy's local record shop, and there's this record, and the guy behind the counter said, isn't this you? It was something like that. And then that was it. And then still to this day, I mean, that was on Gary Crowley's compilation, which was out in June or whatever, Punk and New Wave. But even when we were doing the Users, we did a good couple of It's Not True off the Who first album. And we were doing things like Lies, the Knickerbockers, which was off an album called Nuggets, but it's very Beatley and stuff like that. We weren't sort of, you know, sticking in one kind of area.
You recently as well, I don't know if this was a lockdown thing, but revisited that, remastered it and released it back on Bandcamp, right?
That's right. And that remaster thing is getting touched up again. And that's going to be coming out on Japanese vinyl. That'll be coming out, I imagine, early next year. But all the way, I didn't realise, because I stopped me doing music years. We must get back to the Wellerfeller at some point. But I stopped doing music for years and I moved back to Cambridge from London. I was walking down Mill Road and this guy, Greek Paul, as we call him, sort of local DJ, came flying up and goes, "You've got to play Sid Barrett Memorial, Grand Chester Meadows." And I go, "Oh, I don't play anymore." And he goes, "We'd already swapped numbers." And he goes, "Oh, no, you'll get a phone call when you get home." And he wasn't hearing that I didn't actually play anymore. I get home, there's a phone call going, "Oh, you know, can you learn four songs or so and play this Memorial?" And that's how all this later period suddenly started, because I went and did this thing. And then we got a call from Dizzy Holmes, who runs Detour Records. I go, "Oh, how'd you get the number?" And he goes, "Oh, I saw you were in Cambridge, Sid Barrett, and I phoned up Directory Inquiries." This was when Directory Inquiries, and there was a free, and he got my phone number. And then he said, "If you've got any tapes, unreleased tapes of the Users, we'll drive up from wherever it was, Guildford or somewhere, Medway or whatever, and we'll, you know, you can come and put it out." So that's suddenly how it all...
Oh, wow, that's incredible. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
All and from that little conversation in the street with that fella.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's where, yeah. And then what happened was, like, he said to me, "Oh," just before it was coming out, he goes, "Do you know you've been on all these compilations and these kind of things?" And I was going, "No." And I think he got to a point, because we'd had so many conversations. He sort of, this was just like the day before his song was coming out. I think he was sort of thinking, either this guy is playing real dumb or he really doesn't know. Yeah, because I didn't buy a music magazine or anything. You know, I was fully involved in sort of doing a retro shop and then retro T-shirts and all this kind of thing and making up shirts and stuff. I wasn't following music at all.
Let's talk Mr. Weller. Let's talk Respond, because it'd be interesting to understand how that all came about. So Paul Weller creates Respond, and this is, I guess, the final phase of the Jam, if we talk about them. And this is, in his mind, this is basically like a Motown project, isn't it? And it's all about promoting young artists. It's this label that's part of Polydor, but it's his label. It's his project. It's him and John Weller. Really takes off in the early days of the Style Council. We have people like Tracy Young. We have some really interesting records by The Questions, and Paul Barry's been on the podcast. Dolly Mixture. The late Vaughan Toulouse.
Love Vaughan.
So a really interesting project. And we'll talk about the fans aspect, because some people are so fanatical about this label, as you'd expect. But how did you come to get involved? Was it you sending off a demo? Was it Paul hearing about you? Was it that fella in the street? What was it?
Lucy was, she was like a backing vocalist in Cambridge when I was doing the Users to a group called The Heartthrobs. I came out the Users. I remember stopping that, thinking, "Oh, I can't do this anymore." Then I had about a year poodling about in London, or maybe it was 9 months. Time goes sort of, it's all fast at that time. And then Lucy turned up on my, I don't know how she came round. Maybe she came round with a mutual friend or whatever, David Stevenson, it could have been. I think I played a couple of chords and she went, "What?" or whatever. And then I thought, "Oh, I'll come round again." And we wrote about four songs in about sort of 2 hours or something. You know, it was just like very easy. And then it was like, wow, that was pretty productive. And this was in Queen's Park, Top of Notting Hill. And then she was working at PRS, Performing Rights Society. There was a bass player there, Rich Starting. It was like, "Well, let's go and demo," you know. And so we did. And then immediately, sent off those demos. And then I remember we were now living in, I mean, so long ago, Dan.
It was 40 years, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking, hang on, that was Queen's Park. But I remember getting the first call from Weller, and I thought I was in Kilburn then, Kingsgate Road. And I remember that I was on a landing, and it was about it seemed to be close to midnight. At that time, I think I was slightly sort of away with the fairies or whatever. I don't know what someone had given me. But anyway, the phone goes, and then his voice on the end of the phone, it's about midnight, and I'm lying on the sort of landing as I did, and that's where the phone was, on the ground. And I pick up the phone, and it goes, "Hello, it's Paul here. I'm really excited by the demos, our virtual demos. Do you want to come in Solid Bond?" And I'm going, "Who's this?" It's Paul Weller. And at first, I thought it was a wind-up. You know, I thought, "Oh, God, this is a bit of a wind-up. This isn't, you know, it's midnight. What's going on?" But it turned out to be real. And then we went down to Solid Bond and met Paul. And from there, I think about the next week, we went in, we'd give it some emotion or whatever. And he said, "Oh, I'd really like to give this to Tracy. You know, what would you think about that?" And we would just go, "Okay, yeah, go along with this." And somewhere around there, we must have signed to Respond.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think when you think about that Motown model as well, the other thing Paul was trying to replicate was you. It was for your writing as much as for your performance, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You're all like writing for each other. Like Paul would write for Tracy, you'd write for Tracy, questions write for, you know, for themselves, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a real kind of mixture.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because the fans may have liked it, but the music press was definitely totally against it, or there might be some positive articles one could dig up. But generally, there was a sort of feeling like, and I don't know why, it was like, you know, I think they were trying to have a go at Paul by going, "Oh, you can't do this, you know, like you can't set up and think you're this or something." And so that was a real shame. There were some great gigs. I remember playing Kingston on Thames, and, you know, we went up around the Midlands. I think Aston University, well, we went up to Scotland, everywhere. There were some really good times. And I did like hanging out. Vaughan was a great guy. And I remember when we were playing in East Anglia around Norwich and places, he would just drive by the Red Beetle at the time, Volkswagen. He would just come with me and Lucy in the car. So we'd just be driving off around. And there was a lot of people sort of seemed to be sort of like really, but I mean, Vaughan was a lot looser. And he was sort of out of the mode that you'd expect.
Yeah. Well, you had these Respond package tours.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you'll be traveling around the country. This was April 1983, and the Respond Posse tour, and Tracy and Vaughan and people like that. And I think you not do Hacienda in Manchester.
Yeah, yeah, that was a great gig. And funny enough, when we first got on Facebook, I can't remember who it was, girls started writing to us, going, "Oh, I saw you at the Hacienda," and it's something. Boy, but I remember playing that place thinking, this is really good atmosphere here, and I really liked it. And then subsequently, obviously years later, you think, oh yeah, it's was an iconic place, but it definitely had a vibe there. I really enjoyed that one. Yeah.
There was also one for Paul's 25th birthday, which would have been one of the really early Style Council things. And this was the Paris Theatre in London. I think you were part of that lineup,
for the BBC. Yeah?
And the questions were on the Style Council, Ron.
Yeah. And all around that time, I remember, first off, I think we were having some rehearsals, and Steve White came in, and he was rehearsing with us. And he was about 16 or whatever. And I remember saying to Paul, "Oh, we'll have him as our drummer. He's really good." And Paul goes, "No, I'm having him as my drummer." And he literally hadn't played live with Paul then at all. It was kind of like... thinking, yep, he's the drummer. And, in fact, someone who passed away last year, who I got to know later on, or in the whenever, another 10 years back or something, at the time, Simon Wells, he gave me a sort of bootleg cassette or some kind of recording of that Paris thing, of what we were doing. And it's really weird. I think the first song, or the first two, or definitely the first one, I have no recollection of it whatsoever. You know, it's like we must have written it that week, played it on that night, and never played it again.
It was like
sort of watching film of yourself in, you know, a different country, or speaking a different language or something, and thinking, yeah, that's me, but and you think sort of halfway through it's going to jog something, and you're going to go, oh yeah, I remember that, but not at all. I played it two or three times. No, so that was a really good gig. And I do remember Paul rehearsing Times Are Tight, Jimmy Young cover there. And I thought, bloody hell, this is a number one. You know, he's got that. Has got to be a single. Do, 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 do. Yeah, times and time. Get it, get it, get it right. That had everything for me. It had sort of Style Council, Jam, everything in there. And I mean, obviously, he had so much good material himself. I don't think they ever... They didn't actually ever record it, did they?
No, it wasn't ever recorded. Actually, that was the only time they ever performed it live as well.
Oh,
let's stay on the live gigs, because wasn't there a support culture club? Was that Brighton?
Yeah. That was a thrill. Say the gig was Saturday. We get a call on something like Friday afternoon from Joe, the tour manager guy. Well, I had a fantastic team around him. John Weller, obviously, and his mum and sister. And then there was Kenny Wheeler. And then there was Joe, the tour manager. And just this little nucleus of really good. And anyway, he gives us a call going, oh, what are you doing? Something like, what are you doing tomorrow, guys? Well, do you want to support Culture Club at Brighton Conference Centre and whatever it was, be it Solid Bond, and we'll be driving down or whatever at so-and-so time. The funny thing about that was we went on. I don't think we were announced. The sort of lights were down. We go on, and then suddenly I feel things hitting me, you know, not hands, but like things were hitting. And then suddenly the lights go up. There's this huge intake of breath, like, and then it was like, who the fuck are you? And then there was suddenly all these like sort of little dolls of Boy Georges all around feet that have been sort of thrown on stage where I think they thought we were going to be Culture Club or something. You know?
Brilliant.
And so then, but that was great. And we held them off for about, I don't know, I think we played about 35 minutes. And they didn't really get restless till about the last song. You know, I think we did very well there. But that was great. I think God knows how many that place holds. You probably know.
Yes, yeah, I've been there a few times. It's a big old venue, isn't it? But they were all like Boy George lookalikes in the audience as well, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, they were number one at the time with Karma Chameleon. It was actually number one. Boom. I do remember the sound check where they went round everyone individually, and they had that backing vocalist, I forget what her name was, Helen someone, and they did Private Number as the Stacks tune, as a sound check thing when they all came together, and that was fat. And I thought, bloody hell, they're good. You know, like, I remember saying to Paul on the, whenever it was, Monday back in Solid Bond, that they were much, much better than I thought they were going to be. They could all play, that's for sure.
Let's talk about recording. So you get the offer from Paul. You mentioned you've written Give It Some Emotion. That becomes a Tracy Young single. But in terms of you and your band, how many sessions did you have recording in the studio?
We had lots. I mean, there were more tracks, actually. We did a version of You Got to Be Kidding or You Must Be Kidding. And we went round to, this is Lucy and I, we went round to Pete's, and it was absolutely a stomping version that he did all these sort of brass parts for. Tracy subsequently recorded it, but that initial demo, which I didn't have a copy of, or Lucy, was fantastic.
So how did it work then? You obviously had a job, and then you suddenly get the Respond deal. So you were giving up the job and you're on some kind of retainer, presumably, are you?
Yeah, on a retainer, weekly retainer, which was something like £50 a week, which probably in today's would be about 300 quid a week or something. You know, I know this would be,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it probably is about that. Yeah, I don't know what I was doing before. I did odd jobs before. I was kind of working in Kensington Book and Toy Shop. I can't remember. I did all sorts of things. I did actually that thing of washing dishes at the BBC that the Flash sang about in Career Opportunities. I actually had a week of doing that. Lucy was obviously at PRS. I can't remember what I was doing beforehand.
I love the fact that you just jack it in, though, and suddenly you're on this retainer. And for like 18 months, you're part of the Solid Bond setup. You're part of the Respond record label setup. Well, as team, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened, basically, yeah. And I remember being down in the studio all the time when they were recording Café Bleu, being at a lot of those sessions. And I can remember Paul borrowing my acoustic to show DC Lee Head Start for Happiness at Noma Studios. I remember him coming in, oh, can I borrow your acoustic, Chris, and going through. And the best one in the Paul recordings thing. I mean, I was there for all those One Who Got Away and all the rest of it. I get a late night call from Pete Wilson, and he was going, look, Chris, come to the studio, get a cab down, come to my blotch. You've got to tell Paul he can sing this song, do this vocal. So get a cab, and it was about midnight getting the cab, like say, I'm up in Kilburn, so get a cab down there. And there's just the Weller fella and Pete Wilson, and he's doing the vocals to Long Hot Summer and Paris Match. And Paris Match, he's like sort of, you know, getting full on into it and not thinking he can sing it, which I think is why, you know, he had that Tracy Thorn come and do it, Mike DC lead, you know. But, you know, and this went on for quite a time. I remember him coming through going, you know, what do you think should be the single out of the two? And I was going, Paris Match. It's got to be Paris Match. And, of course, it was Long Hot Summer. Well, I mean, like, you know, the A-side or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I was also amazed at the time Paul had that total overseeing thing where, you know, he was actually doing it there in, I mean, maybe they did some demos for it, or I don't know how much was actually done in Paris, but he had that whole angle and going over with Pete Anson. That was a fantastic photo session. Pete Anson was great, by the way, photographer. He did a load for us. He had that thing of not just sort of like, here's another single, you know, there was that whole sort of internationalist and this is the Paris EP, you know.
So you mentioned Pete Anderson, who part of that setup in those early days, the Style Council, but it's linking in with all the work that he's doing with Respond, and Simon Halfen's heavily involved
as well.
It's all like a total team mentality, a team effort, isn't it? All these people working really collaboratively and inspiring each other. So let's talk about this. Here we get it. The single, I've got the 12-inch here. This is,
oh, look, it's Lucy.
There we are, wearing a jumper. Lucy looking fabulous on the front cover. This is October 1983, this comes out. And it says, A-Craze are Lucy, Chris, Rick and Mark, featuring Mr. Michael Talbot on Wurlitzer, produced by Brian Robson and A-Craze. Photography, Peter Anderson, like I say. And this is the single. This is the only single that we had as a release, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that it still is a physical thing, right? You've got a record out there. It's an amazing thing to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, no, a real feat. That all came about because I think we'd recorded Dumb But Not Mute as the A-side. At that time, we'd spent about 4 or 5 days recording this other track, but it was all just like, it felt really stiff and I don't know, it just wasn't right. And but there was a fantastic dub version, which is Portabella in dub. That was what was supposed to be on that 12-inch, and they went and printed up the wrong one, you know.
So, right.
Yeah, that vocal Dumb But Not Mute on there should have been, I think it's even titled on there, isn't it? Titled Dumb But Not Mute.
Oh, so yeah, we had Wearing Your Jumper, we had She Is So, and then it's not mentioned on the sleeve, but it'll be mentioned on the actual vinyl, right? Yeah, dub, comma, but not mute.
Yeah, and that is the what is on the Such Bliss compilation. It should have been the dub version, which I'm really proud of. I think that was such a good little mix and such a good vibe. And I think that would have enhanced that record a hell of a lot. But anyway, so what happened with that? We'd been recording this Dumb But Not Mute and we'd done the dub version. Lucy and I wrote Wearing Your Jumper, went into Solid Bond, into the canteen, because that thing you were saying, everyone used to sort of go there and hang out or whatever. And I can remember playing Paul this new song we've written, and he goes, oh, that reminds me of Dionne Warwick or something. We've got to record it. And then it was like, okay, let's book a studio on the Saturday morning. Solid Bond was booked up by somebody else or whatever. And then we went down to Victoria to do it in a day, you know, studios down there. Yeah, Mick Talbot and Steve White on percussion. Yeah.
I remember reading, I think it was on the sleeve, it must have been the sleeve notes for the Such Bliss album, Lucy talking about the fact that we were at a motorway service station, I think, ringing Solid Bond to find out where it was at in the charts.
Yeah, that sounds likely. I think it did get to about number, it's probably there in the notes. I don't know. Something like number 44 or 46 or something like that. God, well, that's a game when charts were important. I couldn't even tell you what were in the charts now. I don't even have a clue.
No. And even like there, people's reaction now would be, okay, they didn't get top 40. And that must have been disappointing, I'm sure. But actually, to even get to that number, you had to sell a shitload of records, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is odd, you know, the amount of sales that things did used to clock up. I'm not sure of the exact sales there, but I do remember... The Users, that first single I was going on about, where we had to settle, we settled out of court. This was like, even when it had been out just about 9 months, I think my dad got lawyers in to take him to court, the guy who put it out, or records, and he sold 20,000 singles at that point. And he said, okay, I'll give you £2,000, settle out of court, and that would be that. And subsequently, it was bloody sick. Years and years and years, you know. And it was kind of like, well, 20,000 isn't sort of anything, you know. But I mean, now, I guess 20,000.
You'd be number one for a month for that, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that 12-inch, I think it's collectible now. A guy that I've recorded a little bit with, Oliver Popincourt in France, he picked up a copy about a, I don't know when it was, about 18 months ago. I went, wow, I've got this, you know.
We'll talk about the Japanese compilation stuff, but this was the original Respond compilation. So this comes out whilst the record label is live. So this is 1983. Yeah. And you got the little cassette there. Look at that.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And it's like a sampler, I suppose. It's Paul introducing the Respond's act to the world. We get different tracks from The Questions and Tracy and A-Craze and Vaughan as the main TKO. It's called Love the Reason, so people know what I'm talking about.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
And your track was Keeping the Boys Amused.
Yeah, which I prefer the instrumental that came out on the, again, on the Japanese one. It was a good little session.
Well, let me read the notes here, right? So it says on the album, this is on the back of the sleeve, it says A-Craze, Respond's latest signing and a very mixed bag. Chris and Rick's guitars sound like Hampstead Chic. Lucy is a brilliant and original lyricist. Their songs contain a mixture of melody, mystery, and magic.
Yeah,
sparse, sparse as autumn, but with bright outbursts to follow. They wrote Tracy's smash hit, Give It Some Emotion, whilst planning further conquests.
Yeah. He was a bit psychic there, as in we were living in Kilburn, which you could almost call West Hampstead, but we did end up in Hampstead, you know, with the West Hampstead Housing Association. I always thought, when I read that, first, I thought, that's a bit weird, us being Hampstead Chic or something. But then
that became a reality.
Later, that's where I end up. Yeah. That was the last times I bumped into the Weller fella too. He parked up there and he was probably going off to see some 90s Britpop star. But yeah, I bumped into him there.
Early 1984, Paul does this interview with Kid Jensen. I don't know if you heard this at the time or remember this from the time. We're obviously going back a long way, right? But he talks about how, at that point, he talks about how Respond Records was basically unworkable. And I think you kind of nudged on it earlier where you were talking about the press were giving him such a hard time. The industry itself, he said, and he talks about the fact the industry was totally geared up for profit and not for creativity. It was just hard to make this project work, wasn't it?
Yeah. Everyone on Respond, I think there was a lot of diversity there, but it was all just getting pigeonholed into just like some Paul sort of play thing, and like it's just keep smashing him. It wasn't sort of getting a fair hearing, it didn't seem. Also, all started getting a bit pressurized, I think. I mean, I think there were some great releases. I mean, A Tuesday Sunshine, I always thought was out of this world. Everything and More, Dolly Mixture, brilliant. Obviously, Tracy's stuff. And yeah, it was like Born to Lose. Is, I can remember being in the studio for Fickle Public Speaking. And I thought, well, that's obviously going to hit like crazy. And it was bizarre. None of these things really took off, you know, took into that. So there was a real reticence for people to, I think, any probably in the industry, and he would know more about that, to kind of get behind it. And they were probably saying to Paul, I have no idea, concentrate on the Style Council and, you know, use your energies for that. Don't worry about all this. But I mean, the funny thing is, I think all these early Style Council songs are absolutely, you know, the top peak of all that.
It was such a productive time. And from what I've read and from what you're saying as well, it feels like all of you were inspiring each other and topping each other and encouraging each other. So it feels like there's so much creative energy involved that you're all just building, doing more stuff, giving this song to this other person, all that, right?
Yeah. And everyone was between sort of 18, 19 to, were you saying, well, it was 25 then or something? 24.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it would have been, yeah. So yeah, you've got that youthful energy, yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's young. I mean, it's quite weird now when I play around, and even sort of playing in games, people say, oh, there's this great young new group or whatever. And like, you'll see the players and they're all about 28, 29, 30. And I'm sort of thinking, yeah, I mean, you know, music is ageless and all the rest of it. I've learned that. But it's, you sort of look back at those times and it's kind of like, wow, you know, people were really young. Yeah.
But also, I think everybody thought, when, you know, at that point, like when you become 30, your career's over and that's it, you're done and dusted. You've got nothing left to say in music, have you?
Well, that's it. I definitely was a paid up member of that. I remember getting to sort of about that age, or 28, 29, thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to. I did some other group, and I remember we were playing at the place in Camden, which now gets called the Barfly, but it was called something like the Monarch or something at the time, and had Bellstar on bass. I forget what her name was, and who used to be bass player of Bellstars, and I was thinking, but I really didn't like, a nice guy, but I really didn't like the drummer. He was a bit flimsy, and I remember playing the sound check and thinking, I just can't do this. I've got to get a proper job, you know. This is like, and I said, this is the last gig to the Bellstar girl, and then after the gig, that was it. And the whole thing was like, I can't, this is, you know, got to get a proper job now. And then I went and did sort of film courses and stuff like that, Camberwell Arts College, and did an art history course. And yeah, and I just thought, like you're saying, too old to be doing
washed up, yeah.
this kind of thing. This is ridiculous. Whereas now I'm kind of like, I'm doing music all the time.
You finding your muse again, I suppose, became the sound of pop art, and this has been since around 2010. More recently, you've worked with Andy Lewis, who's been on the podcast, was obviously part of Weller's band. Lovely, yeah. Lovely fella. I think it's still the record for the longest episode of the podcast, as you would expect, probably.
Yeah.
So how did that connection come about?
I phoned up the tour bus when they were coming to Cambridge, and I think there was tour manager Bill, and I said, oh, can I get on the guest list or whatever? And this was, you know, like as they were driving up or something. And they said, oh, wait a minute, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, put you down, it'll be Chris Free. So, and then when I got there, on the side of the Corn Exchange, suddenly Andy Lewis is there. And I go, oh, hi, Andy. And he goes, and I go, oh, Chris Freen, who's going, oh, and his immediate thing, which no one ever says to me, he goes, you're good. That was the first thing he said to me. And I go, oh, right, that's nice to know. And he goes, yeah, no, we were playing. No, he said they were playing A-Craze on the tour bus when they came into Cambridge. Maybe they haven't had this such bliss because I don't know. And then we made that connection or whatever. And in COVID, the great COVID times, I'd asked him, something after that, I'd asked him about a singer. I did a CD before, and he'd used a singer on maybe a $1 billion project or whatever. And I was wondering if I could get hold of her too. And I ended up with Carla Milton or Louise Turner, one of the two. But then in lockdown, we were messaging each other about something or other. And he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm sitting at home. What are you doing? Sitting at home. And it was kind of like, he said, have you got any songs? I said, well, yeah. And then it was like, oh, well, wind them down to a click track, like a sort of metronome thing on a key stick, and I'll build up my end. And so we did this like lockdown EP, which came out on Spin Out Nuggets.
A Mad Affair EP, and technically your first solo release under your own name as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it had to be. I mean, I've got a great partner in crime with all the music, Nat Sarah on yet, my bass player. But I mean, the last four or five, whatever, I think we've done 6 albums, but definitely the last four have been like sort of solo out. I mean, I write all the songs, I do the arrangements, but Sarah is a sort of mainstay of that. I think every other person has sort of come and gone and all the rest of it. And anyway, because I never wanted to be a singer. I always wanted to sort of be in a group anyway. There was no way of saying this Mad Affair EP was a group. I couldn't get away with it. And I think Lee Grimshaw from Spring Out Nuggets and Andy said, well, it's got to be Chris Free. You can't say this is that. But funny enough, on this latest album, they were both saying, oh, it's got to be Chris Free. And I actually, I did prefer the artwork with the TSOPA on than Chris Free down the bottom.
Oh, really?
yeah, I thought that looked visually better, you know.
So this is Shapes and Shadows, which is the latest song. Yeah. Came out in June this year, again produced by Andy, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm really proud of this one. I think this one's what everything's been leading up to. And I'm sure I'm going to blow my own trumpet here, but I can't imagine there's too many better LPs released this summer than that. You know, regardless, you know, it's hard to get reviews. And I've had people, you know, it's getting played all round. So
I'll tell you what, though, what stands out for me, right, is that as yet, this hasn't been a sunny summer, right?
No.
The only sunshine coming out of this garden office I've built is your album, my friend. Because there's nothing else going on this summer. That's where the sun is.
Well, the thing was, obviously, a lot of it was done last summer, you know, and we were, you know, like the first track. I mean, probably four of the tracks we actually made up on the spot. I kind of like, I'd have a germ of an idea. People come round and then bang, we do it. Things like the first track, and there's one called, funny enough, which is like a Respond instrumental. It's called and I ended up calling it the Lost Cafe Society. Phil Robinson, a guy who buys a lot of stuff and all that, he goes, "That's so Respond, that." And it does sound like that, which is why I titled it that. But we were doing it up in my loft in Cambridge, which is tiny sort of space, and it was really hot. It was a definite hot day or two, and we had to have all the windows shut, sort of blind half down to try and keep some of the sound in. And we were like sweat, absolutely sweating away, you know, like sort of drenched doing this. But yeah, felt great. I mean, because Andy was absolutely superb. He's got these superb microphones and, you know, they cost thousands down. And he's an absolute technician and great guy to work with. And it was, and I'd said to him, I do not want to, I'm not paying to go into a studio. I've got, you know, no one buys music to make it worthwhile to go into a studio unless you're some established artist. Otherwise, it's some vanity project, you know. So I said, there's no way going into a studio. And he said, well, you know, I've got these mics I can bring around your house. The first song that he heard, I sent him a song called From the Beatles to the Bomb, and I sent it to him because up the road, like 3 or 4 houses up, I kept hearing this drum beat going on, you know, someone playing drums. We got asked to play a fashion show, which was all Arts Council funded, but we were only going to do like 4 or 5 numbers. It wasn't worth our regular drummer coming from Colchester. So Sarah and I did this duo, but on the way home, oh, the next morning, I'm hearing these drums. And I'm sort of thinking, I know that two sisters lived there. One was like 19. I knew a younger one. And it was a boom, bah, boom, boom, bah, boom, boom, bah. I thought, oh, well, that's a Motown beat. You know, I think, that would have been good to have had, you know, last night or whatever. So I get in contact with the mum on Messenger and said, hey, I didn't know the name. So I said, but, you know, would you thought to like try a rehearsal, you know, just like try out. And anyway, she goes, oh, yeah, I'll bring her round. I thought, that's funny, bring her round. Anyway, she turns up at the front door, and it's not the older sister, it's the younger sister who looked about, she was 15. And I thought, oh, no. And initially having some kind of age thing. And she goes, oh, yeah, she's really excited to, you know, come. And I thought, oh, my God, we've got to do this. Anyway, so that long story short, we go to the rehearsal, start doing couple numbers, and then start doing this beat for one. She's whacking these toms, and I'm thinking, fucking hell, this sounds fantastic. You know, this is like Hal Blaine or something. You know, it had a real 60s kind of Ronettes kind of thing going. And I kind of video a bit on my phone, and I sent it to Andy that evening. I was thinking, my God, this sounds like so authentic. And he immediately writes back going, Chris, book that room. I want to record that drummer in that room with you doing that song. Don't change anything on the same kit, which was just a rehearsal drum kit. It wasn't even a kit. I want to record that. Recorded six tunes like that. And then it's like the rest of the things, he did the drumming. Like he drummed in. It was the back to this thing where I'd give him an acoustic run through. He'd put the drums down in his shed, and then we'd do the rest of it up in the loft. But for any Respond fans or whatever, that is, you know, I think they'll find something there. Shapes and Shadows, the actual track, Boots from even where Andy's playing bass on Bringing It All Back Home. That's very Respondy. It's all there. Beach Life, of course, which is Gary Crowley's played about the past 3 weeks for his show and dedicated to whatever friends of his or whatever that. And that gets played on Italian national radio too. That one is very straight out of that kind of time. And
I should ask you before we go, there was also a few albums ago now. This was on the album To Dream the Most Fabulous Dream, a version of Shopping, the Jam.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that came about because Spiritualize, which was some kind of cancer raising project thing where they wanted, I think, sort of Weller songs or something like that, and recorded it for that. And then I just put it on that album too. And we did that very, you know, that was like literally 2 hours or an hour and a half. It was straight through. Well, basically, we're in the studio with a piano player, Sean, Sarah and me, with an acoustic and a bass. And I think we had 2 hours to do it in and have it mixed. So I think we put a shaker, well, there's a shaker on it, and that was it. And I wanted to, you're not going to do the same thing as the Jam or whatever. I mean, whenever do covers, try and put your own mark on it. But I did get those kind of style counsel-y chords more. I thought that was quite good, actually. I liked it going into that sort of slightly Who sort of thing we kept going back to. And I do reference Circles at the end, leading me back to you, Mr. Weller.
Have you had many connections with Paul since the Respond days?
No. Apart from asking him for permission to use all the A-Craze demos and stuff from Solid Bomb, which he said, you know, well, why not? And, you know, like I said, I bumped into him in Hampstead, and that was about it. I couldn't believe I went to Gary Crowley's, one of his Christmas do's. He has a social where he was doing a disco, and he said to me, I said to Paul, you were coming down. He said, oh, sorry to miss you. I'm doing something with my family. And I couldn't believe that conversation had taken place at all. I mean, I thought, I don't know, you know, that seems a bit odd.
You mentioned getting the permissions for the demos from Paul Weller there for A-Craze. And this would have been for Such Bliss, which was this compilation album. Such Bliss, 1983 to 1984, A-Craze. And this would have been released around, what, 2010?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And that came about because MySpace, which was the sort of thing before Facebook, suddenly I was getting these, I think I put something about A-Craze or something like that, and you say A-Craze. And then there would be these little comments down the bottom of the page. I think you had a picture at the top. It wasn't like Facebook. And this Japanese person wrote saying, we love your A-Craze CD. And I went, oh, thanks, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then didn't think anything of it. I thought, well, we never had a CD. And then suddenly about, you know, 2 days later, oh, I have your A-Craze CD. Really good. And then I'm thinking, what A-Craze CD? And then I kind of I did a search on the web, and then somebody found this I forget the name of it. Terracotta or something.
Trattoria, wasn't it?
Trattoria, so right.
Yeah, this Japanese label that was reissuing all these things in the late 90s, weren't they?
Yeah, which I knew nothing about. And I remember Tracy knew nothing about it either. I remember contacting her at the time going, hey, do you know about this? You know,
none of you have seen a penny from it. Yeah, they're just selling all these CDs, right?
Yeah, you got it. They'd done a deal with Paul and John Weller, yeah. And no one knew anything about it, yeah.
Yeah, I remember buying all those because I got into Weller, would have been 92, 93. Yeah, 92. You know, obviously then he becomes massive. You know, you get this, you know, Stanley Road and all that, Wildwood and all that. I remember those CDs. I remember getting them on import and that was my initial discovery of Respond and then getting the vinyl and all that. Yeah, I remember those CDs like it was yesterday because you all got all the bonus tracks and stuff. And
Then what happened from that was this other Japanese guy got in contact with Fast Cut Records or whatever, going, you know, have you got any other recordings? You know, we'll put something out if you got them. And that's when I suddenly dug up all the, you know, these cassettes of demos or whatever, you know. I mean, there were 15 tracks put on. I mean, there were ones I didn't put on, but I wish we'd just kept it about 10. But at that point, CDs, there was a craze at one point there. No pun intended there. But there was a time where CDs always had about 14, 15 tracks on. They've now gone back to this 9, 10 sort of album, sort of more LP vinyl format. But then it was this kind of thing to have, was, you know, way more tracks. So he was going, we've got to have 14 tracks, you know, and thought, you know, whereas now I think if you'd just been 10 or so, it would have been very nice.
As part of that, we got a couple of new songs as well. There was Shooting Star and July Ran Away. They were brand new songs, were they?
Yes. Well, Shooting Star was, I'd just done that year or something like that month before. That was one after the Syd Barrett thing. I suddenly woke up the next day and I wrote a song called England in June. I thought, oh, that's really good. Didn't think, I thought that's the first song I've written in about God knows what, 10, 12, 14 years or something. I actually woke up with it, you know, one of those like cliche things where it was just playing and it came out and it was sort of like, that came from nowhere. And then about 2 days later, you know, I wrote another one. Then suddenly it was all coming out and I was thinking, this is really weird. It's like a gift from God or something. And then I got in contact with Dennis Munday. I said, Dennis, actually, you know, I've got some good songs coming out here. And he writes back and he goes, Chris, I retired in 2003. I live in Italy and the music business is totally finished. and I was sort of like, hey, I'm ready to go.
Yeah. This is my time.
Yeah. It really was like that. I thought, all right. Oh, really? You know, and then Shooting Star was one of those. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to go and record these things anyway.
Did you reconnect with Lucy then on that?
Yeah. So Lucy,
oh, wonderful.
She had some, because I said about that we need all the tapes, and I think she had some tapes maybe that I didn't have, or I was just checking that she didn't have any cassette tapes that, you know, I'd forgotten stuff. And for instance, like I was saying, that Simon World, that Paris Theatre one, I mean, we must have demoed that, but neither of us had it because we were demoing every week in Denmark Street, in that Penpan Alley thing, studios. And I remember stuff being sent to the Heaven 17, the girl singer on Temptation or whatever, and she was going to record one. And we'd have to go there every week and record about the three new tunes. And God knows what happened to all those cassettes. I mean, you know, you do so many moves over the years that these things get lost along the way. Anyway, so Shooting Star was one of those. When we were mastering it with James Perrott somewhere down in Plymouth or Portsmouth, one of the two, I met Lucy there and she did that. And then July Ran Away with the Moon, or July Ran Away, was actually an A-Craze one again that we didn't have a cassette of, that we'd written at the time then, back then. And I just started doing it on acoustic there in these little control room, studio room. And then James Perrott, the engineer, and Lucy started singing it. And he goes, look, why don't we just record this? Why are you doing it now? So he put two mics, and so we did it live. So she sang over one side of the room, and I did the guitar, and boom, that was it. And that was great. And Yeah, I enjoyed that one a lot, actually.
That's so lovely, isn't it? Because that would have been, what, 25 years since you recorded together at that point, would it be?
Yeah. And I hadn't seen Lucy for about 8, 9, 10 years. We could flip back into it straight away, which was really good. But I remember around this time, you're jogging my brain like crazy. Mark Bax of Mono and all the rest of it. I remember him calling us up, and I was actually in Camden at the time, at Camden Market, and they were doing some kind of lunchtime concerts up in the stables there. And Bax said, oh, do you want to get together with Lucy and play there, you know, because some of us, you know, remember the band, and, you know, do you want to get that together? I didn't offer that to Lucy at the time, but I think, you know, it seemed not right to do that.
It's a different thing getting back into the studio versus suddenly you're playing live in Camden Market, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the end of the podcast, there are always two questions. They're always the same questions, okay? You're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Star Council, or Solo. What would you go with?
Oh, my God. It's got to be The Jam, I suppose, although it could be The Star Council.
or Paul Weller Solo, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'd probably go... one song. I mean, that is really difficult. I probably go, I can't do one song. I mean, I love the band version of Head Start to Happiness. I love the acoustic version of it. I'd probably go Paris Match, but if we're going into The Jam, I love Liza Radley. I love Away From the Numbers, Tonight at Noon. I like Shopping.
Here's a good test, right? So the podcast finishes, this conversation finishes. What is it that you shout at Alexa in the corner to play you?
Shout to the top.
Were you part of the setup when that was being recorded? I'm trying to remember. No.
Just out. And I can remember there was a publicist called Chris Carr who was something to do with all of that. And I remember bumping into him on Kilburn High Road and him going, who's got a good one, a real good one. His latest is a real good one. And, you know, and then I thought, yeah, that is proper weather. And, you know, every now and then you just hear one and it cuts through and you think, yeah, that is like, you know, those tunes are sort of just come God-given, I think.
Final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourself with these connections to Mr. Weller, hear your stories about your music, your creations as well. But really, the reason I created with the podcast was to get an interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. It's my one big regret. So if it happens, what are we on now? Nearly 160 episodes, for Christ's sake. If it happens, Chris.
Really?
Wow. I know. If it happens, Chris, what should I ask him?
Have you heard any of Chris Free's stuff with the sound of pop up?
Here we go. I heard him crucify Shopping. No, I'm joking.
No. Yeah. No, put it to him. Yeah, no, I think so. Andy Cross did the mixes for To Dream, yeah.
Yeah, Andy Cross has been involved as well. It's almost that 6 degrees of separation thing, isn't it? It's like, you know, Mr. Crowley, these links are all there, you know.
Well, they are, I mean, because all these people, they're still passionate about the music and they kind of understand all references. And the one thing, like I said, that weren't allowed to pick up on with Response, and I think even Weller gets pigeonholed with this a lot, is that the diversity, like, you know, there's lots of different styles going on, whereas like a lot of other genres, like you're a funk group or you're a goth band, but when you're doing this kind of more soul pop R&B, bit of rock, alternative folk work, it's all there. And these kind of people actually understand that. Samba, bit of bossa nova, it's kind of all mixed in, and obviously northern and so on and the rest of it, but it's all in there. You know, these people, like you mentioned, like your Crowley's and Baxter's and obviously Andy Lewis is like, boom. And soundtrack, you know, I love sort of soundtrack music and all the rest of it. So they kind of understand that. And it's just such a shame that a lot of this stuff gets pigeonholed as, oh, that's just mod or something. If I come up with any other things, I'll probably walk away from this and then start.
Guests always do, my friend. We can put anything in the show notes. And, you know, Chris, this has been so lovely hearing your stories and what for some you would think would be like a little nugget in time, a little 18 months of working with Weller. But actually, there's so many connections here. It's wonderful.
I never mentioned it for years, but yeah, no. But once getting back into music, you suddenly get there. Like that whole period where I wasn't doing that, and I can remember somebody who's now married to Richard Thompson, the folk singer, Zara. I remember doing stuff with her. I don't know when that was, probably late 80s or whatever. But the thing was just before stopping or whatever. I can remember having a conversation on Facebook about, God knows what, about 4 years ago. And she was going, you never mentioned anything about this sort of respond. And I was working with her for about a year. And it was just like, I didn't, you know, it was just that's gone. A bit like Lucy. I think it was like, well, that's gone and that's that. That was that. Last thing, I mean, the whole change in my philosophy with it is like I work for this arts organization charity. So I do a songwriting workshop each week on a Thursday with isolated people or neurodiverse, which basically means sort of they could have had breakdowns or they, you know, they're long-term unemployed and they don't fit in society anyway. So it's Arts Council funded and all the rest of it. And I do that and I go in there and we kind of write a couple of songs in a couple of hours or whatever, or I guide them through it, you know, do a few lines each, play a few loose chords and they're sort of a few of them learn guitar too and then take that and knock it in shape. We're going to record six tracks of that, which I think is basically going to be a product and it's going to go with my other half does art work classes. And that's really great doing that. And then like last night, I said, I started this open mic where usual open mics around this area are all sort of rock blues and they all sort of go, and I said, no, I want to do this different. We're just going to have acoustic. If people want to read a poem out that they've done, anything, try and avoid just the sort of people playing Johnny B. Goode or a slow rock blues. So I was really proud of how that went. And then at the same time doing this album and I love playing live now with Sarah. We went and played Paris the other month. That was great. We've been asked to go back October 7th. I love all that. And I love the podcast thing where, you know, tracks are being played in sort of Italy, Japan, France, Spain, the US, California. It's amazing. You get played so many times on Spotify and you get something like 0.005 cents a play. It's just absolutely crazy.
I know. Yeah. The model is so broken, but it's also so different. I mean, it couldn't be any further away from what it was 40 years ago, could it?
Yeah. So the only way you make money is actually, well, things I get paid well for doing the songwriting class and to playing live. It all just tops up. And then these kind of recording projects are just sort of, I don't know what they are. Sort of, they're like, they're pop art. And the reason I called it The Sound of Pop Art initially was a reaction to, I think, that whole Simon Cowell thing at the time, X Factor. And I was thinking, well, that's pop, or they were classifying as pop. And I was thinking, well, what I'm about to do is actually pop art because now people aren't really going to buy this stuff, but it's actually like, you know, some artist like splashing something up and trying to sell it for 100 quid in the local cafe or something, you know. Yeah. That's exactly what it is, because you're not going to sell 20,000 copies or anything.
Hey, Chris, this has been so lovely. Good luck with what's next. Keep in touch, keep sharing the music with us, and we'll keep updating the show notes on the website as well. But thanks for joining me, man.
Nice one. Okay, au revoir.
What a blast that was. My thanks once again to Chris Free for joining me on the podcast. Do check out the show notes for this episode to find everything you need to know about A-Craze, that Such Bliss compilation CD and download with extra tracks, and the stuff that he's up to currently as well. The new 2023 album produced by Andy Lewis called Shapes and Shadows by Chris's band, The Sound of Pop Art, and his Mad Affair EP. All details in the show notes for this podcast. Whilst you're on my website, do get yourself into our store. You can get your official podcast mug and t-shirts, plus via virtual coffee if you fancy it. Hello to Rich Gill, who's done exactly that. Thanks to you for your support. Hello, John Reed. Hi, John. Hello, Peter E. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee, sir. Martin Bonhom. Hello, Martin. Hi, Mike C. Hello to Simon Cartilage. Martin Glover. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. If you want to get involved, paulwellerfanpodcast.com on the web. You can get in touch on social media, on Twitter or X or whatever it's called this week. It's at WellerFanPod, or on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.